Natural Birth and Death Are a Necessity by Hassan Rashid. First Chapter. Title Introduction. Our technologies have obscured the roles of natural birth and natural death, but the fact is that both natural birth and natural death go hand in hand in making the Earth's species diverse and sustainable. Due to our misguided concepts of birth and death, the planet is overpopulated by humans, and the cause is that the birth rate is greater than the death rate. For example, the human population has exploded from a few tribes in Africa 300,000 years ago to a global population count of 8 billion today, predominantly due to our technical achievements. Today, 96% of the biomass of mammals on Earth consists of humans, their pets, and farm animals. Only 4% consists of all the wild mammals like elephants and chimps. To the author, this appears to be the opposite of what nature had intended, and the reason being for a major part, the avoidance of natural death at any cost through the use of technology in general and the medical fields in particular. I am not saying that the avoidance of death is not natural, but that technology has made it possible to cheat nature out of the necessity of natural death, which guarantees a diverse and flourishing community of species. Ultimately, it is a battle between nature and human ingenuity. New chapter. Title: The Prime Directive. The Prime Directive is a biological concept and designates the process that all life follows to reproduce. There would be no life without it because everything wears out and stops working after some time. Examples of reproduction are mitosis in single-celled species, egg laying, and giving live births in multi-celled species. It is a process of self-preservation, seeking shelter, gathering resources, and constructing new individuals to take over when the original one deteriorates or is about to do so. But resources such as shelter and food are not uniformly available on Earth. This meant that the individual had to find them first to make any benefit of them. The scattered resources put limits on the individual's abilities to perform the prime directive and required some plan or strategy. Through evolution, there were many ways or strategies by which this was accomplished in different species. The following is a short discussion of some of these strategies. Physical. Physical characteristics help the species find the right resources to affect prime directive. Size is a good example of a physical characteristic to help a species do that. If the resource of the species is large, then the species needs to have a large mouth or large strong teeth to tear it apart to get into its mouth. Another physical characteristic is the species configuration. For example, a tree has roots underground to absorb nutrients and water, while its leaves are above ground to absorb air and sunlight. Another physical characteristic is the rate of giving natural birth or laying eggs. That would seem like a no-brainer, since that is what the prime directive is trying to achieve. But, in reality, it is not as simple as that. For example, you can't give natural birth or lay eggs faster than the availability of resources. In addition, a species that is more efficient with its resources will give more births given the available resources than a species that is not. Then there is the natural death rate of a species. It is not known if there is an internal clock for all species that signal the end of life, but in the case of some fish, there is. Salmon, for example, will swim upstream to where they were hatched, and females will lay eggs while the males fertilize them, after which they both die, leaving the eggs behind. If they did not die and lived to compete with their young when they hatch, there would not be enough resources around to keep all alive. So the salmon through an internal genetic clock perform a selfless act for the sake of their young. Resources. Energy is an important resource needed to achieve the prime directive. Without it, nothing would live. So we will find different species pursuing energy from different sources and in different ways. Plants have their photosynthetic leaves aimed at the sun to gather enough energy to grow and fulfill the prime directive. In turn, animals will consume the plant matter in leaves to gain the energy within. These herbivores may be consumed by carnivores, who in turn gain their needed energies. Shelter is another important resource in the lives of many species. For example, squirrels seek holes in trees to nest and protect their young from the elements. Birds gather twigs and leaves to make their nests. Behavior. Another physical characteristic is the development of a central nervous system. It is most often represented, but not limited to, the brains of mammals, and its purpose is the transport of the species, the monitoring of its surroundings through sensory organs, and decision-making. For example, making decisions when the individual is in danger, to fight or flee. To ensure the success of the prime directive is the process of selecting the correct mate in the case of a sexual species and rejecting others. Other behaviors involve the advent of populations and the relationship between its individuals that might manifest themselves in aggression, altruism, and various characteristics in between. Of course, we can't leave the subject of the central nervous system without mentioning its ability to make tools as exhibited by the primates who make sponges out of leaves for drinking water and rockets to invade outer space. Summary. The prime directive has a self-preservation motive to help it perform its other tasks of sheltering, gathering resources, and reproduction. For example, a hermit crab is a small species and is vulnerable to attack from others. To save energy, it seeks the shelter of a long-gone shellfish shell instead of building a shelter from scratch. Once that is done, it is relatively free to seek resources and to reproduce. The prime directive guides on an individual level. But we can see that the world is not just individuals, but populations living together in environments scattered throughout. How do these populations get along without consuming each other and everything else on Earth? What is the role of natural birth and death in maintaining diversity and sustainability? New chapter, title, The Earth Before Humans. It is no secret that nature in general makes things rounded or elliptical, such as the planets and their orbits, while humans create things that are mostly straight, square, or rectangular. Sure, humans create round things like plates and rockets, but those are the exceptions. It is also true that nature creates jagged things like rocks, but those are on their way to becoming smooth and round again, thanks to rolling and tumbling due to weather, volcanic activity, or earthquakes. So it should not be surprising that the following discussion revolves around cyclical concepts. First, we will discuss the cyclical nature of inanimate entities, and then we will move on to the living. New chapter. Title, Earth's Cyclical Nature. It is no secret that nature in general makes things rounded or elliptical, such as the planets and their orbits, while humans create things that are mostly straight, square, or rectangular, such as their houses, towns, and agricultural fields. Sure, humans create round things like plates and rockets, but those are the exceptions. It is also true that nature creates jagged things like rocks, but those are on their way to becoming smooth and round again, thanks to rolling and tumbling due to weather, volcanic activity, or earthquakes. So, it should not be surprising that the following discussion revolves around natural cyclical concepts. First, we will discuss the cyclical nature of inanimate entities, and then we will move on to the living. Earth is a self-contained system. Hardly anything comes into it from outside, except for sunlight and the occasional meteor. Rarely anything leaves the Earth except for a little reflected sunlight and an occasional molecule of air floating into outer space. What is the general logic of Earth cycles? They help us explain how an atom or a chemical compound moves through its environment, starting in one part and moving to another, only to return to where it started with no or very little accumulation. There is an endless number of cycles taking place on and within the Earth right now. The cycle that can be perceived most readily is the water cycle, which begins in the oceans, lakes, rivers, and on land. As water vapor ascends through the air, forming clouds. These clouds will, in turn, drift along until the moment they give in and fall in the form of rain, snow, or ice onto land to form streams, creeks, and rivers, eventually emptying into lakes and oceans, or else are absorbed by the land. The water cycle takes a year or more to reach completion, and other cycles may take less time or much longer. For example, Earth's crust consists of tectonic plates of rock, sand, and mud moving very slowly and colliding with one another. Science tells us that at their collision points, one plate with all its mud and sand can slip under another, producing extreme pressure and heat. This results in volcanic activity that throws molten rock from deep beneath up to the surface. The rock cools and over millions of years breaks down to mud and sand once again. Carbon dioxide also exists in the oceans, air, and underground. Carbon dioxide is balanced between the atmosphere and the oceans, as the atmosphere and the oceans exchange carbon dioxide according to their temperatures and composition. Scientists like to talk about these as carbon dioxide cycles. A major cycle in this regard is the photosynthesis-respiration cycle of living matter in the biosphere. For plants, photosynthesis takes carbon dioxide and water to produce oxygen, sugars, and starches, which many, if not most, of the living depend on for energy. With respiration, the reverse can be observed. Oxygen and carbohydrates combine, releasing carbon dioxide and water again. New chapter. Title: The Living Cycles. In the simplest of terms, life is a chemical reaction requiring energy. With a fixed amount of incoming energy from the sun hitting our planet's surface, lowering the amount of energy required for this chemical reaction to take place allows for a proliferation of life. If the reader asks how they might lower the amount of energy required for a chemical reaction, the answer would revolve around the availability of catalysts, such as enzymes, which are the biological catalysts. In most cases where an enzyme is required, reactions occur faster because they require less energy to activate the reaction. You can think of a catalyst as a tool like a wrench, which makes it so much easier to unscrew a nut. So increased energy efficiency using tools such as an enzyme occurs when mutations in our offspring lead to more efficient enzymes. As far as we are aware, the cycles discussed in the carbon dioxide cycles are neither the rule nor the exception for the movement of matter on and within the Earth's mantle. However, they are certainly present in each species in their circulatory systems. Specific groups of species, such as those found in a forest, circulate matter too. One can say that energy drives the circulatory system of forests. Without it, forests would collapse because each of its links, whether one species or a piece of inanimate matter, provides a tiny link in the larger overall forest chain or chains that provide a way to recycle life-giving nutrients. These recycling chains make these nutrients available for the regeneration of the forest. For example, on a smaller scale, when looking out a window or strolling through a park, the reader may observe trees, birds, grass, and bees, to name just a few of the life forms present in our surroundings. When focusing on a flower merely as an object, it may appear entirely independent of the other objects around it. Still, it is intimately connected with all other objects in its immediate vicinity. A clover, for example, needs soil to grow. As a mature plant, it later provides nourishment for the bison that roam the plains of the Midwest of the USA. The puma, meanwhile, later hunts out the bison for food. When it manages to bring one down, it drags what it can of the carcass to the shade of a tree to eat. Flies gather around the carcass to feed, lay eggs, and try to avoid the birds that feed on them. The above explanation is simplified, but it shows how different species are so closely interlinked. A more accurate representation of the cyclical link between species is shown in the following graphic. The graphic shows a circle with different species on its cusp. Each species is followed in a clockwise direction by an arrow. Starting on the left is a green shrub with an arrow pointing to the right to a goat, meaning that the shrub is the food for the goat. Another arrow points from the goat to a lion, meaning that the goat is the food for the lion, and so forth. The lion is followed in order by a fly, bird, amoeba, and a bacterium. Following the biological cycle explained above, clockwise, starting with the green bush at the top left, a story can be told of how nutrients flow from one species to another. First, the bush extracts water and minerals from the soil, and with the help of the sun and atmosphere, produces tender leaves, some of which are consumed by the goat to build its muscle, maintain its growth, and hopefully also give birth. The lion consumes the goat in turn. The leftovers from the goat are used by the fly to lay its eggs. Some birds will feed on those flies, while the goat, lion, bird, and fly leave behind fecal matter that is consumed by various microbes such as amoebas and bacteria, which return the nutrients to the soil once again. On any given territory, there are multitudes of life cycles, but perhaps with different species that participate in returning the atoms and chemical compounds, nutrients, to the soil and into the atmosphere. In addition, these living cycles can often be interrelated. For instance, a living cycle that starts with a bush can have more than one grazer consuming it. They may be goats, sheep, or deer. These living cycles can take on complex shapes. Looking at a square acre of land and trying to describe the number of living cycles within it, one may count many millions of combinations, and their arrangement may look like a ball of chains. Living cycles are not limited to food either. They can be observed in nest building, territory, and so on. To take the example of a bird building a nest in a tree, when the eggs hatch, the nest may fall to the ground, where insects break it down and pass on the resulting matter to amoebas and bacteria, which will return the nutrients to the soil to be used by the bush. A forest is an example of an ecosystem. Like any ecosystem, it contains megacycles of circular chains involving the air, soil, water, plants, the sun, and animals. A forest is not the only ecosystem. A desert, such as the Sahara Desert, is also considered an ecosystem. In conclusion, life's cyclical nature. The chain of life is circular, meaning that there is no start or end, no top or bottom link, nor is there any intelligent link or any particularly unintelligent one. The chain is nevertheless very complex. It contains many circular side chains. You can imagine the chain as a solid sphere where no one circular chain can be distinguished from another. So what keeps the ecosystem from collapsing if, for example, lions kill all of their available prey in a day or two? New chapter. Title: Balancing Species Populations. To have a balance of species, natural death rates must equal natural birth rates. When looking at the relationship between a lion and its prey, the gazelle, for example, the African lioness eats from the herd of gazelle to satisfy her hunger. She hunts in a way that always leaves enough gazelle for her to pursue the next day and the next year. If she and her cohorts finished off the whole herd of gazelle, then her cubs will have nothing to eat the next day or year, and they will die off, resulting in their extinction. One key factor that gives stability to this living relationship is sleep. In the wild, it has been observed that lions sleep for 21 to 22 hours a day and go hunting for gazelle or other prey only when their bellies rumble. To conserve energy, lions pursue only the slowest individuals in the gazelle herd. If an element of sleepiness was not present in this pride of lions, one can imagine the lions hunting all day and bringing down as many gazelles as they can, which would ultimately break the living relationship between predator and prey by decimating both populations and lead to their extinction. Thus, sleepiness is a form of natural control characteristic of lions that ensures the survival of both the hunter and hunted. Other key factors to consider here are the territoriality of lions, where the larger the territory, the more gazelles there are to survive, and the increasing speed of gazelles that protects them against overhunting. So, living relationships are stable over time, largely due to the genetic characteristics of their participants, which have mutated into a form that fits the environment and ensures their survival. Unstable relationships in nature, such as when birth rates are not equal to death rates, for the most part are rare and most likely to collapse. The teeter-tatter of earthly life. This balancing act can be represented by a teeter-tater. For the species to survive, the teeter-tatter board must not touch the ground. If it does, the species will go extinct. You may ask how this balancing act is achieved. Imagine a balanced teeter-tatter for one species on the left side, such as a rabbit. The rabbit has a high birth rate, which would tilt down the teeter-tatter on the left, which is countered by a high death rate due to predation on the right side. So as the birth of one rabbit happens on the left side, there must be a death on the other side of the teeter-tatter. If the species is a good hunter with a low death rate, then for it to keep the teeter-tatter in balance, it has the traits of a low birth rate. It just so happens the lioness in the previous section has this trait. It should not be a surprise that two or more traits can help a species balance the teeter-tatter. For example, a gazelle has a higher birth rate and can outrun many of its many predators, resulting in a balanced teeter-tatter. The Balancing Act is not restricted to a single species, but may include two or more species. For example, there can be a balancing act between a predator and its prey, where a good hunter may sleep a lot, and the prey can run faster than the hunter both. Traits reducing the appetite of the lion and the death rate of the gazelle. In the case of the lioness and the gazelle, we know that the gazelle also needs to eat. So, in reality, we have a serial relationship involving two teeter-tatters. One is of the lioness and the gazelle, and the second is the gazelle in balance with the grass it feeds on, where the grass grows faster than the gazelle can eat it, keeping the teeter-tatter in balance. Here we have a predator who consumes prey, and in turn, the prey consumes grass. It is assumed that the grass needs water to grow. So far, we have not explored what will happen if anything unexpected happens. For example, what will happen if the rains stop and the grass dies? In this case, the gazelle dies off and their teeter-tatter becomes out of balance, and in turn, the lioness and gazelle teeter-tatter collapses, resulting in the micro-ecosystem collapsing. If the pride of lions only ate gazelle and the gazelle only ate grass, the result would be the extinction of the lions and gazelles. The good news is that many species are diversified in what they eat, so you might be able to imagine parallel teeter-tatters, where the lions also consume warthogs, and the warthogs eat legumes instead of grass. You might say, if there is a drought one year, wouldn't the legumes also die out? The answer is yes. But the legumes have deeper roots, so they can access deeper groundwater and stay alive. The grasses leave behind seeds that can last for several years, so they will come back when the rains return. The imagery starts to get very complex when you consider an ecosystem where there are countless numbers of serial and parallel species, teeter-tatters, or relationships, as biologists would put it. These relationships attest to the resilience of ecosystems, where if the unexpected happens, there are alternate cyclical and balanced paths that can be taken. To conclude, plants capture the energy from the rays of the sun and uptake water and minerals from the soil, which all cascade down to animals, insects, and microbes, where the original water and minerals in the life-giving resource are returned once again to the soil. This is the way it started and the way it has to continue on this planet. All species, large and small, whether as large as a whale or as small as an amoeba, deserve to live and have their habitats unspoiled for their own sake. They are not meant to be destroyed. They are meant to thrive. It will be shown in upcoming chapters that we must seek a simple lifestyle that pursues humble pleasures controlled by nature. We need to return to our original sun god for sustenance, happiness, and rebirth to prolong our days on this beautiful planet, for time will not be our enemy as it is today, but our friend. New chapter. Title: The Forest People. Humans first participated in the balance of species communities and were intimately connected to nature. They took just enough for their livelihood, no more and no less, and moved on, allowing nature to replenish whatever they took. They acted like the pride of lions in that their behavior did not take more than what other species could provide in the form of food and shelter without going extinct. From present-day indigenous peoples, we learn that this balanced relationship between humans and other species required they be in nomadic hunter and gatherer communities that moved from one area to another, allowing nature to recover. The Forest People. The Forest People, Turnbull, Colin M., 1962. The Mbuti people live in the Ituri Forest, a tropical rainforest covering about 27,000 square miles of the north-northeast section of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Africa. Mbuti are pygmy hunter-gatherers and are one of the oldest indigenous people of the Congo region. They are composed of bands ranging from 15 to 60 people, with a population hovering around 30,000 to 40,000. Location of the Ituri Forest in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Africa. The Ituri Forest has a high amount of rainfall annually, ranging from 50 to 70 inches. The dry season is relatively short, ranging from 1 to 2 months. The forest is a moist, humid region strewn with rivers and lakes. Diseases are prevalent in these conditions and can spread quickly, killing not only humans but major sources of food as well. Too much rainfall, as well as droughts, can greatly diminish the food supply. In the rainy season, they forage in part of the forest, and during the dry season, they expand their foraging territories. Their wild animal foodstuffs include crabs, shellfish, ants, larvae, snails, pigs, antelopes, monkeys, fish, and honey. The vegetable component of their diet includes wild yams, berries, fruits, roots, leaves, and kola nuts. While hunting, the Mbuti have been known to specifically target the giant forest hog, which is often considered quarry, a bad animal that may cause illness to those who eat it, and is commonly used as a trade good between the Mbuti and agriculturalist Bantu groups. Folklore has it that the quarry giant forest hog is nocturnal and a disruptor of the few imported agricultural activities the Mbuti practice. Mbuti societies have no ruling group or lineage, no overlying political organization, and little social structure. The Mbuti are an egalitarian society in which the band is the highest form of social organization. Leadership may be displayed, for example, on hunting treks. Men and women have equal power. Issues are discussed and decisions are made by consensus at fire camps. Men and women engage in the conversations equally. If there is a disagreement, misdemeanor, or offense, then the offender may be banished, beaten, or scorned. The forest is the center of Mbuti life. They consider the forest to be their great protector and provider and believe that it is a sacred place. They sometimes call the forest mother or father. An important ritual is referred to as Molimo. After the natural death of an important person in the tribe, Molimo is noisily celebrated to wake up the forest, believing that if bad things are happening to its children, it must be asleep and not taking care of them. As with many Mbuti rituals, the time it takes to complete a Molimo is not rigidly set. Instead, it is determined by the mood of the group. Food is collected from each hut to feed the Molimo, and in the evening, the ritual is accompanied by the men dancing and singing around the fire. Women and children must remain in their huts with the doors closed. These practices were studied thoroughly by British anthropologist Colin Turnbull, known primarily for his work with the tribe. The remoteness of the Mbuti people has protected them and their environment from the outside world for the most part in pre-1960. Their natural birth and natural death rates are high and roughly equal, and as a result, there are no overpopulation problems. Modern advances, such as medicine and other technologies, have had a rough time reaching them. Although there is no formal constitution or government, the context of their being is in their belief system. They are one with the forest. This factor has helped the Mbuti people escape the non-cyclical problems of other modern and advanced peoples, such as deforestation, overuse of resources, pollution, overpopulation, and the accumulation of toxic wastes. Just a few difficulties. Summary: the forest people of the 1950s who lived in the eastern Congo region evolved to fit in the Ituri forest. They are well equipped with creativity to solve problems there. For example, they make tools made of available vegetation, such as nets to capture prey. They also have a strong sense of the self and its relation to the tribe and the forest. They acknowledge their survival depends on belonging to a healthy forest. The forest people also have a much enhanced communication system through verbal and nonverbal languages that allow them to disseminate their relationship to the forest between individuals and generations. There have been records of the forest people in the literature of the ancient Egyptians, so we know their existence spans thousands of years, and thus have maintained a healthy balance with their environment for that long. If we try to apply the prime directive to the forest people, we find that they fear natural death, linking it to the spirit of the forest. They take time out to build their shelters out of readily available local materials and hunt for and gather food locally, which is plentiful, expanding their territories when it is less so. Their natural birth rate is equal to their natural death rate, since there is no evidence of extinction or overpopulation. But most important is their belief system. There is no reason to think they have any less mental acuity than we do, and therefore they have constructed a successful survival belief system where they live intimately within their deity, the forest. We will then discuss how the forest people differ from the civilized. New chapter. Title: The Advent of the Civilized. At some point in time, a population of humans embarked on the path that led to overpopulation, an explosion in the use of technology, and an alternate source of energy than that of the sun to fulfill the happiness of the human element. This population is currently known as the civilized. Outside of the forest people's domain, the civilized are not as intimately connected to their environment as the forest people were. The civilized preferred to have deities that were detached from their local environment. The ancient Mesopotamians believed that their deities lived in heaven, but that a god statue was a physical embodiment of the god himself. As such, cult statues were given constant care and attention, and a set of priests were assigned to tend to them. These priests would clothe the statues and place feasts before them so they could eat. A deity's temple was believed to be that deity's literal place of residence. The gods had boats and full-sized barges normally stored inside their temples and used to transport their cult statues along waterways during various religious festivals. The gods also had chariots, which were used for transporting their cult statues by land. Sometimes a deity's cult statue would be transported to the location of a battle so that the deity could watch the battle unfold. The major deities of the Mesopotamian pantheon were believed to participate in the assembly of the gods, through which the gods made all of their decisions. This assembly was seen as a divine counterpart to the semi-democratic legislative system that existed during the Third Dynasty of Ur, to 112 BC to 2004 BC. Mesopotamia, on the eastern end of the Fertile Crescent, what is now Iraq, was the cradle of Western civilization. It has the distinction of being the very first place on Earth in which the development of agriculture led to the emergence of the essential technologies of civilization. This was followed by civilization appearing in Egypt. Civilizations also thrived in the Indus Valley by about 2500 BC, in China by about 1500 BC, and in Central America, what is now Mexico, by about 1200 BC. In early civilizations, technology was often focused on agriculture, construction, and transportation. Early humans developed tools such as plows, irrigation systems, and boats to help them farm, build homes and structures, and travel across land and water. Civilization is considered by the civilized as the stage of human social and cultural development and organization that is the most advanced of any other population of humans. It is an advanced state of human society in which a high level of culture, science, industry, and government has been reached. The civilized are people or nations that have reached such a state of advancement. Unfortunately, with the advent of civilization came a parting of ways with nature. On the one hand was the cyclical nature of the way things worked on Earth, and the other was the civilized way that used technology to change the course of humanity away from it. The self-preservation motive inherently says that the self is the most important entity in the universe. When it was translated through the group, it had a far-reaching effect on the psyche of the civilized individual, where they believed they, as part of a cooperative unit, were at the apex of life on Earth, which gave them the right to do whatever they wished to do. This new psyche followed the prime directive to the letter. But technology amplified each step in the prime directive process, and that interfered with its original intent on a personal level. For example, the emotion of civilized empathy carried medical supplies to every corner of the globe, upsetting the local natural birth rate to natural death rate balance, helped today's results in a global 8 billion population each clamoring to live. Technology amplifies the expectations, needs, wants, and perceived rights of the individual. God was no longer of the environment, but of the stars, which allowed them to play any role in the lives of the civilized. The civilized were able to start exponentially amplifying these original desires of the human component through creativity, energy, and technology in approximately the year 1800 AD, through the introduction of industrial capitalism. The next chapter will discuss some of the innovative but nature-disconnected solutions that civilized humans were able to come up with through the use of industrial capitalism. New chapter. Title: Evidence of the Disconnect. We the civilized are very inventive and creative. we came up with several inventions and creations that helped us multiply our resources, our population counts, and our consumption of resources. But first, we held the belief that we were at the apex of life on the planet, and that anything we did was okay. We then invented a monetary system where we could carry the value of something without actually carrying whatever it was with us. For example, I can carry the value of an apple with me from the United States of America to England without actually carrying the apple with me. This disconnected the value of the apple from the apple itself. Another invention of ours was we made the apple have any value we wanted it to have. For example, we could probably buy an apple for $1, but if we buy a dozen, we could probably buy them for $10, which makes each apple worth an 83 cents. To a biologist, chemist, or physicist, this should not make sense because they have some ideas as to what it took for the apple to be produced. It probably took 10,000 calories or more of sunlight to produce the 300 calories that are in an apple. And this equation does not change at all in nature, whether one or a dozen apples are produced. We then created an economy that tries to make resources as low cost as possible by inventing the supply and demand graph or equation below that says if a resource becomes scarce, then its cost to the consumer should increase, and vice versa. It is said that the increase in the price of a rare resource will allow the producer to expend the extra profits they acquired to find more of it or a substitute. So, we the civilized have been busy using our creative brains to come up with solutions to make nature fit into our idea of what the world needs to be like. We created a negative-sum game world out of the zero-sum game, Appendix C. We claimed that our idea of how the world should work was better than that of nature. The side effect of this economy was the generation of the need to increase wealth through an increase in demand, through an increase in population, so that factories could produce more products to meet the demand. As the population grows, the need for more jobs leads to more factories, which leads to the need for more people to buy their products, and the cycle continues endlessly. The endless economic growth cycle. Unfortunately, in the end, the Earth is the entity that pays for this economy, an economy that assumes the Earth is endless in its ability to provide. That the Earth will deliver enough zinc, for example, and if the civilized can't find zinc, technology will substitute another earthly mineral to fill the gap. There is another effect of this economy. It stratifies the value of raw materials to end products, where raw materials have a lower value than the end product. The value-added inverted pyramid above shows how the value of Earth at the bottom is ignorable under the current economy. In other words, when the current economy sees a tree, its salivary glands start to work harder since the tree's cost value is zero. What the economists don't understand is that the Earth one day will run out of zero-value resources. The question here is, when will they realize this fact? Besides, to a scientist, the logic and the premise of the economy are impossible to work with since all values are temporary, which is a major flaw. We need to get back to the subject of natural death, which is not immune to the illogical effects of the economy. Natural death in this economy is to be avoided because keeping people alive is one way of building capital and wealth for medical facilities like hospitals. The logic of staying alive has crept into our cultures for a long period, and it has not been, but in more recent times the suffering of the patients has been taken into account and granted the wish to die. We now will cover how our illogical economy came about. New chapter. Title: The Human Limits. We might ask why the civilized embarked on this path of creating a reality of their own, challenging that of nature. After all, they are natural beings, acting naturally, and we would think they would stick to true and tested natural concepts. The author has come to understand the human brain and its two most basic limitations. The first being a physical limitation in the quantity and quality of information it can store. The second is a result of the limitations of its sensory organs in perceiving reality. In simple terms, nature is infinite while humans are finite. Therefore, humans will never be able to understand nature and how things work in the universe, let alone the Earth. Although our brain's memory is limited in information, the brain can manipulate information and even create it. This is perhaps best demonstrated in how we solve problems. For example, by bringing together two different memories and producing a third that may solve some need. Unfortunately, since memories are limited in information and the process of linking two of them follows no natural law, the result is an abstract and creative solution that will not necessarily prove to work in the real world. We must now realize that the structures of the brain and those of reality are quite different. To help us visualize this, let us imagine that an understanding of the creative world generated by the human brain comes in the form of a stack of square blocks, with natural counterparts coming in the form of circles or spheres. We might well imagine the blocks of our imagining to tumble and fall if built on a sphere. When building a square structure on a round reality, it immediately becomes unstable. According to such logic, most of what humans can conceive of or build will be disconnected from the natural world and fail. We should rather try our best to follow nature, which inevitably proves more durable than anything we could have created. In whatever we do, we should let nature set the path, because nature is the final authority on what is right and suitable. Nature is complex. Humans are, in fact, incapable of grasping its full intricacy. We should have been wise and considered ourselves part of and not separated from Earth's living cycles, the web of life and its ecosystems. Notions that humans are at the top of the food chain and humans have a superior intelligence are vocalizations of an inflated ego. We are but a link, no better or worse than any other, be it a clump of mud or another species in Earth's organization of life. The interference of our intellects has fed our egos, leading us astray and blinding us to their consequences. As we accept the miracle of birth, we should also accept the necessity of natural death in maintaining this beautiful planet we belong to. If we don't, then dire consequences will follow. New chapter. Title: The Consequences. Current evidence indicates that we, the civilized, are returning climate conditions to their levels 60 million years ago, when global temperatures were higher with different atmospheric chemistry. There is no question as to whether civilized activities are driving this process by exhuming ancient fossil fuels. It is as if nature is pulling the civilized by the nose to show us the extent to which our current activities are unsustainable and need to be changed. The following are a few excerpts from the headlines invading our information systems, showcasing the results of our activities. The civilized population boom. The human population has exploded from a few tribes in Africa 300,000 years ago to a global population count of 8 billion today, predominantly due to our civilized activities. Today, 96% of the biomass of mammals on Earth consists of humans, their pets, and farm animals. If the ultimate achievement of a species is to increase its numbers, we might ask at this point, are there any negative side effects to the apparent success of the civilized? Extinctions. We are living through a biodiversity crisis. The fastest mass extinction in Earth's history is happening right now, largely due to the actions of the civilized. According to the calculation methods of Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson, 700,000 species have become extinct since 1976, largely due to the loss of part or all of their habitats. This biodiversity crisis has been snowballing for the last 100 years, and many experts predict a sixth mass extinction is on the way. Many species have become extinct because of hunting and over-harvesting, the conversion of wetlands and forests to croplands and urban areas, pollution, the introduction of invasive species, and other forms of human-caused destruction of their natural environments. Indeed, current rates of human-induced extinctions are estimated to be about 1,000 times greater than past natural background rates of extinction, leading some scientists to call modern times the sixth mass extinction. The loss of habitats. With the domestication of a limited taxonomy of plants and animals, more and more lands are required to support them, which results in a loss of habitat for the rest of the plant and animal species of no interest to the civilized. For example, in the Northwest United States of America, beef cattle are raised on ranges where they compete with other indigenous species that naturally inhabit those areas. This competition is further weighted against the wild species by the civilized population's tendency to hunt, kill by shooting, or poison those undesirable species. For example, the puma has been reduced in numbers by shooting and killing to protect the cattle grazing in their habitats. Another example is that of the wolves, who are perceived as killing livestock and therefore are killed, poisoned, or burned in their dens. Soil erosion and degradation. Natural processes moved rocks from their resting places down hills and gullies through the power of wind and water currents, causing them to collide with each other. All these movements and collisions resulted in the formation of soils some 450 million years ago, when plants started to take root after evolving from much simpler organisms. Since then, soils have moved and developed through the very same processes. In general, stable soil is one where the soil is removed from an area at roughly the same rate as the soil is deposited. A much more recent problem is the loss of soils at a much faster rate than their deposition. This is the result of civilized human action, such as overgrazing, where the soil is exposed to elements such as strong winds and floods from a lack of cover, or inappropriate cultivation practices, such as plowing. These actions leave the land vulnerable and unprotected. Soil may also be degraded by salination from the application of chemicals such as pesticides and fertilizers, nutrient loss from runoff from floods, and compression due to other civilized activities such as agriculture and construction. The result of soil erosion and degradation is a reduction in soil fertility and its support of living plants and animals, including the human species. Deforestation. It has been estimated that approximately half of Earth's mature tropical forests, Dear Earth, between 2.9 to 3 million square miles of the original 5.8 to 6.2 million square miles that until 1947 covered the planet, have now been destroyed. Some scientists have predicted that unless significant measures are taken, such as seeking out and protecting old-growth forests around the world before 2030, there will only be 10% remaining, with another 10% in a degraded condition. 80% will have been lost, and with them millions of irreplaceable animal, plant, and insect species. These losses are due to logging, fossil fuel activities, such as exploration and drilling, mining, which carves out huge gouges in the Earth's mantle, and farming, where the old growths are down to plant crops and graze animals, insecticides. Throughout most of human history, insects have been loathed, from locusts that devour whole plantations to termites that feed on the structural wood of houses and the weevil that is a pest of many crops such as cotton. They have gained a reputation as being detrimental to the interests of the civilized. To reduce the effects of these pests, insecticides and pesticides were developed to kill these pests. These are chemicals that are sprayed over the affected crops by hand or by airplane. There are two problems with these applications. The first is the wind may carry the insecticide to other unintended fields, and the second is that they are most often not discriminant of the type of insect killed. For example, some insects were discovered to be rather essential. The bee is just one example. It wasn't until its beneficial effects on pollination were discovered that an appreciation of its services to the civilized began to be recognized. Today, bees are in grave danger from the insecticides used by the civilized to protect plants from other insects and fungi. Honeybees are critical for pollinating food crops. Scientists say the disruption of pollination could dramatically affect entire ecosystems. Yet, many more insects and insect larvae are critical to human existence. The depletion of global fisheries, a report entitled Status and Solutions for the World's Unassessed Fisheries, by the Sustainable Fisheries Group, SFG, has confirmed suspicions held by many researchers that nearly 80% of the world's fisheries are in steep decline. The reasons for these declines are overfishing, caused by a multitude of factors, including but not limited to an unmanaged common, where oceans outside the territories of a country are considered fair game to anyone, and technologies that improve detection and capture of marine wildlife with such indiscriminate methods as gigantic nets that scoured the oceans for any species to feed those masses of 8 billion people. Invasive species and the balance of nature. What makes a species invasive? An invasive species can be any kind of living organism, such as an amphibian like the cane toad, plant, insect, fish, fungus, bacteria, or even an organism's seeds or eggs that is not native to an ecosystem and causes harm. They can harm the environment, the economy, or even human health. Species that grow and reproduce quickly and spread aggressively with the potential to cause harm are given the label invasive. Invasive species are species that are transferred from one ecosystem to another, where they compete with native ones and take over their habitats. An increase in global trade has led to a further increase in the number of plant and animal species that are carried from one part of the globe to another, legally, illegally, or accidentally. Some of these species become pests and wreak havoc on their destination ecosystems, such as rabbits and mice in Australia and blackberries in the Americas, often reducing biodiversity and threatening ecological balance. For example, native to the Indo-Pacific Oceanic region, lionfish are quickly spreading throughout the coasts and coral reefs of the east coast of the United States. Lionfish are voracious eaters, and their venomous dorsal spines have helped to protect them so far from any natural predation in the Atlantic. Another example is the Japanese beetles, which are an invasive species in North America. They are native to the islands of Japan, where their population is naturally controlled by predators such as wasps. These wasps do not exist in North America, and Japanese beetles have become a major pest to farmers growing crops such as grapes. Energy. Other energy sources such as solar, geothermal, biomass, nuclear, wind, wave energy, or other renewables are not the solution. They only give us another way to gouge the ground for minerals, destroy more forests, and obliterate the habitats of other species. We need a lifestyle that consumes much less energy so that we do not affect Earth's ecologies and biota that we very much depend on. Hazardous and toxic waste. Hazardous waste is waste that poses a substantial threat to public health and the environment. Worldwide, the United Nations Environmental Program, UN, estimated that more than 400 million tons of hazardous waste are produced each year by industrialized countries, with about 4 million tons shipped across international boundaries. Most of these transfers occur between industrialized countries and developing nations, where they are disposed of due to the rising cost of disposing of hazardous waste in the home country. Disposal consists of storage, either above or below ground, leaving a legacy for future generations. In the case of biological toxins, they are often incinerated or simply released into the air. Examples of hazardous waste include lead paint that was used in houses before 1968, obsolete computers, their components, and batteries. These types of wastes cannot be thrown into the garbage, for they will contaminate the surrounding soils and groundwater, causing great harm to people and the environment. Capitalism. Capitalism isn't freedom. Its premise is the accumulation of wealth through increased profit. To increase profit, it must cut down trees, gouge the earth, acquire other species' habitats, and pollute the land, sky, and water. Capitalism is serving us, the civilized consumers. There are two problems with this statement. First, capitalist companies are after efficient profitability, where among other behaviors, cruelty is an acceptable tool. Second, civilized populations are encouraged to grow, consume, and waste more to feed the profit mills. We need to abolish capitalism for the sake of restoring our humanity. Water depletion. Groundwater is a valuable resource throughout the world. Where surface water, such as lakes and rivers, is scarce or inaccessible, groundwater supplies the needs of the civilized. Sustained groundwater pumping because of overpopulation causes groundwater depletion and is a key issue distressing groundwater use. Pumping lowers the water table, requiring drilling to greater depths, which in turn makes pumping more expensive. Many areas of the world are experiencing groundwater depletion. Rainfall and snowfall not only replenish groundwater supplies, but also provide year-round water sources for many communities by replenishing snow to mountains in the winter, which in turn provides water in the summer. However, our increasing usage of this rainwater due to water shortages proves a further problem. In addition, the reduction of water in streams and lakes is partly due to groundwater depletion, reduction of the water table, and climate change. Landslides also occur when water is removed from the soil. In addition, the soil collapses and compacts when water is removed or not replenished. The deterioration in the quality of fresh groundwater supplies is caused by saltwater intrusion from oceans, seas, deeper groundwater sources, and the water below the oceans, which are all saline. If we consider that one hamburger takes about 635 gallons of fresh water to produce, the problem becomes clear. To look at water consumption on a different level, the average American household uses 107,000 gallons per day, 2012. The following chart gives an idea of how much we depend on water in the USA. Global warming. Today we are witnessing the very early stages of global warming and its effects, but there are signs we are on the road to more significant changes in weather and ocean patterns. There are many agricultural communities dependent on the annual melting of glacier ice and its subsequent replenishment. In addition, the ocean and sea levels have been rising at the rate of an inch every 10 years and are now accelerating. In the United States of America, forest fires are burning larger sections of land and are reaching higher up the mountains where there was once snow to slow them down. These fires are also burning at hotter temperatures, and trees such as the ponderosa pines, whose seeds germinate when there is a fire, are now dying of the extreme heat these new fires generate. Nitrous oxides. Methane and carbon dioxides play an important role in atmospheric chemistry. They are emitted into the atmosphere. Naturally, mainly because of microbial activities in soils and lightning discharges. Today, emissions predominantly occur because of civilized activities, such as the combustion of fossil fuels, biomass burning, and the use of fertilizers. For example, long-term trends of nitrous oxide concentration in the atmosphere are not documented adequately. Nevertheless, reconstructed emission inventories suggest that large increases have occurred throughout this century. Exposure to nitrous oxides has direct adverse effects on humans, animals, and plants. Nitrous oxides also contribute to the global environmental problems facing our planet, i.e., excessive global warming, depletion of the ozone layer, and acid rain. The following is a chart showing the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Summary. There is no doubt the civilized are the direct cause of this habitat loss and the extinction of species through such events as overpopulation, the transformation of the landscape through agriculture, construction, and forestry practices, pollution, global warming, and the introduction of alien species into existing ecosystems. In other words, the self-proclaimed ideal species of the planet has run amok. So what does our future look like? New chapter. Title, Our Destiny. So where do I start? Where should I begin? The issue is so vast, but Earth's pain compels me to write and to try to find an explanation. I am not to blame, and yet I feel I am responsible. I have departed from Earth's natural path and found myself with my head in the clouds, drunk with power, unable to see the reckless approaches in my advances and treading on Earth's hallowed grounds in ignorance. The rising human population count has a huge impact on water, wildlife, forests, oceans, rivers, soils, atmosphere, migratory paths, and just about every ecological factor you can think of. It is therefore imperative we allow nature to return the balance between natural birth and natural death rates for the human populations. It is true that governments and people are waking up to the facts and are attempting to find solutions affecting our future. As I see it, we have two alternatives in front of us. We either let nature take its course the way things are today, or we change the situation so that we accept nature's ways. Both options are valid. Both options are journeys that we can take, depending on our point of view and aspirations. So let's take each option and see where it leads us. Alternative 1. Let things be. Major extinctions do happen, Appendix A. And at present, our only tool to predict that it is happening right now is science, which tells us that it is most likely so. And now we must come to the uneasy subject of death. Natural death indeed is a process all life on Earth experiences. The natural death we are facing is that of millions of species and thousands of broken ecosystems. No matter how immense the event, it is a procedure of recycling that lays the foundation for new life. Nothing is lost. For example, the Cretaceous-Paleogene extinction event 66 million years ago laid the groundwork for the evolution of humans and their cohabitant species. Atoms and molecules simply move around and eventually return to the land. By doing so, they get ready to bring forth new species and biomes with the help of the sun. As far as our intellect and consciousness are concerned, they will be deleted from the universe forever, along with many vestiges of the voyage that got us to this tragic shore we find ourselves on today. It is necessarily so, simply because we rejected nature's ways and wrought against it with alien ideas. Ideas such as water shouldn't meander, that the secret to happiness on this planet is the accumulation of wealth, the spread of prosperity, and ignoring the necessity of natural death. And so, from the soil will spring forth new species, ecologies, intellectuals, and consciousness. Only nature knows of their kind. We can only hope that these new life forms are nature lovers for at least a while, and realize that they are all an integral part of a fresh new world. Alternative 2. Welcome nature into our lives. Nature is complex. Humans are, in fact, incapable of grasping its full intricacy. Humans belong to nature, not the other way around. The civilized must rid themselves of the notion that humans are at the top of the food chain, and humans have superior intelligence. We are but a link, no better or worse than any other, be it a clump of mud or another species in Earth's natural organization of life. The interference of our intellect and that of the civilized has fed our egos, leading us astray and blinding us to the consequences. The more we took, the less was left for others on whom we are all dependent. Humans are incapable of forming any successful large society or economic system, as observed in the current political and economic turmoil. We simply evolved to be tribal people, meaning we are only able to form successful relationships within small groups. That is why we, the civilized, have so much history consumed in mega conflicts and drama. Indigenous tribes, like those of the forest people, are the salvation of the planet Earth. They live without damaging their environments. They have a nature-based ecological footprint. It is criminal what is being done to them and their habitats. We were once noble beings fulfilling our needs through our attitudes and actions against natural limitations. Limitations that guided us in our participation in the natural cycles. The natural birth of science gave natural birth to technology and then economic theory. Each one of these births cheated us out of our natural contribution to the well-rounded actions that kept us in sync with the orchestra of life in our environments. The natural birth of science did so by amplifying our needs and fears through actions that overcame the limitations set by nature. 8 billion people are unsustainable on Earth. It not only disallows nature to take its cyclical and balanced course, but is driving the extinction of a plethora of species, including our own. Nor can we pretend that scaling down our present systems to half or a third of their sizes is going to do it. That will only prolong the agony of the inevitable. We have to have a whole new approach to the problems at hand. We need to bow our heads to nature because it was the way things had worked in the past, and that needs to work in the future. The following 5 action items will help save the planet from a predicted 6th mass extinction event. The actions of change we need to take. First, humans need to shed science and technology immediately from their consciousness and construct cultures that are more in tune with nature, such as embracing its cyclical and balanced environments as an equal partner in sustaining the life of all species within. To do so, we must adapt a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to help naturally sustain our environments. Second, an armchair estimate, Appendix B, indicates we need to reduce the size of the human population to a naturally sustainable level of less than 10 million. We can do this by stopping all births and letting the natural death rate climb from the current 7.6 to 39.95 deaths per 1,000 per year. For example, when we stop using fossil fuels as a consequence of not using technology, most, if not all, health, food, and transportation facilities will shut down, and nature will take its course. Natural deaths from poor health, starvation, and inability to secure an income will lead to an increase in the natural death rate. This will bring the population down to 10 million in 25 years. Once this is achieved, the population can start giving natural birth to offset deaths once again. Third, while this is happening, the remaining population should peacefully migrate toward areas where it is possible to live without any fossil fuels. This is needed because it is where we evolved, and it is where we can more easily thrive. Anywhere else, it will be harder to live without technology to keep us warm in winter and cool in summer. Currently, it takes fossil fuels to sustain life in those areas, and when we stop fossil fuel use, these places will be uninhabitable. Fourth, to make tools, they should only be made of local resources. For example, to make a hatchet, only local wood, bone, or stone should be fashioned to fit its intended purpose. Fifth, only use the sun's energy that exists above ground. This includes the direct rays of the sun and their storage in such objects as wood, twigs, or leaves. For example, to cook our food, we should only use wood readily available above the ground and not natural gas, which requires technology. By following and sticking to these five action items, a cultural framework should spontaneously develop that supports them, along with a cyclical, balanced relationship with nature that includes the joys of natural birth and accepting the fact that natural death is a requirement of life. It may help to think of any thoughts that diverge from the above five action items as planted in our brains by alien parasites whose intentions are to consume the earth by using us as tools to do so. It is time we face our shortcomings that are eclipsed by an overinflated ego. The domains of nature and that of the civilized are discordant. The domain of nature is where we belong, and there we must return. So let the chips fall where they may. When we immediately stop and abandon our civilized cultures, no matter where they exist, because they are the kernel of all Earth's problems. Stop all current economic activities. Technology has betrayed planet Earth, so we must ban it from our lives. Abandon all science, for it also has betrayed us and the Earth by being the oracle for self-fulfillment. Therefore, it needs to be banned from our lives and the world forever. By doing so, we accept the truth of nature and return to a dignified life. We accept that our current lives are expendable for the sake of the greater planet and whatever remains of life on it. Earth's symphony orchestra of life will be short of already extinct species, but the music created by the remainder will still be enthralling and will continue instead of dying into silence. To prevent it from doing so, we must take off the cap of the civilized and put on the hat of altruists. Only then will the truth be known. A truth only the hunter-gatherer knows. The truth is revealed in every song they sing, in every dance step they take, and in their acceptance of their obligation to the down-to-earth environments and ecosystems they live in. If you are not convinced, turn to your web search engine to help in the hunt for the truth and pursue resources on so-called primitive tribes that have survived for thousands of years in harmony with their environments. New chapter. Title, Epilogue. Natural death complements natural birth in the drama of life. You probably feel uneasy with that statement, and that is okay. Nature does not speak like we do, but communicates by chemical reactions that follow the laws of physics. Humans do not have to carry the burden of guilt as many do for the upcoming biotic catastrophe. After all, we are also reacting chemicals obeying the natural laws of physics. So sit back and enjoy the ride with art, music, song, and dance, for we seem to be on a rudderless ship and Mother Nature holds the secret to where we are going. The end. Copyright C 2024 by Hassan Ahmed Rashid, all rights reserved. No part of this book may be reproduced or transmitted in any form by any means, graphic, electronic, or mechanical, including photocopying, recording, taping, or by any information storage retrieval system, without the author's written permission. Contact ostamed@yahoo.com.